It's no coincidence that the Beatles came from a port city like Liverpool.
Because, of course, the ship's coming from America with all of this new amazing music.
Coming up, a British guide recommends the cultural, industrial, and entertainment sites that make Liverpool a truly enjoyable getaway. Historian Mary Beard clues us in on the evidence you can find that shows us today how far the Roman Empire ruled.
What Rome is very adept at doing is stamping its own mark on the landscape. It's saying, Rome is here. Rome has conquered.
And for a great escape, where you can still get plenty of exercise, try a hiking vacation on the historic trails of Europe. Choosing a good home base can guarantee plenty of things to enjoy.
It's a really nice way to pair big city Europe with very small town vineyard Europe.
Let's help you plan your next vacation in the hour ahead. It's Travel with Rick Steves. You could introduce a fun way to explore history into your next trip to Europe by looking for what the Roman Empire left behind. In just a bit, historian Mary Beard suggests a few good places to look. And long-distance hiking expert Cassandra Overby has some fresh ideas for picking a good home base as a hub for your daily excursions. Our email address is radio@ricksteves.com. Let's start today's Travel with Rick Steves with a look at why Liverpool is a fascinating city and one not to be underestimated. Wedged between North Wales and England's Lake District is the maritime city of Liverpool. Visions of Beatles' early days, stunning cathedrals, a dramatic harbor front, and old red brick buildings draw visitors in year after year. Liverpool's one of the friendliest cities in the UK and perhaps the best look at urban England outside of London. So right now we're going to explore Liverpool with the British tour guide, Jeannie Carmichael. Jeannie, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Rick.
So when you think about the personality of Liverpool, I just love how there's different regions in England and in Britain, and every region has its pride and every region has its accent and so on, and every region has its favorite foods and drinks. And a word I keep hearing when I think of Liverpool is scouse. What is scouse?
Now, scouse is a dish that's called lobscouse. And it's a kind of stew. You see, Liverpool's one of the world's greatest ports, so the sailors coming in would need a nutritious dish. It's basically lamb or beef stew with whatever vegetables you have. It's lobscouse because you just lob everything in.
Oh, you lob it in. That's
yeah,
why I said.
It's
yeah.
Delicious.
Okay.
It's really good.
Are you likely to find that in
on
a menu?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yes.
But does it have anything to do with the personality of the city? Is there a nickname for the Liverpool people?
Well, scousers.
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 Well, there you go.
Yeah.
So that's quite a fundamental part of what Liverpool is all about. So it's kind of like there's a Liverpool accent, of course. We know that from the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a quick wit. We know that from kind of the Beatles, too. Easygoing, coping with hardship with good nature. I think Liverpool's had its share of hardship.
Very much so. Well, you see a huge influx of Irish people coming to escape the potato famine.
Oh, yeah.
And nobody talks like the Irish. So they intermingled, you know, with the native population. So you have this wonderful combination, as you see, of talking.
You know, that's so interesting because I love the Irish accent and I love the Liverpool accent.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't realize there was a connection that way.
Mm-hmm.
Aha! And one of the most impressive museums I saw in the country was about immigration. And it was people coming mostly from Ireland to go to Liverpool to catch the boat to America, right?
Absolutely. It was the great stopping off point.
Yeah.
But not only Irish people, Liverpool had the first Chinese community in Britain because they came across to do the laundry for the sailors.
Oh, so I didn't realize that.
Yeah, and the first black population as well.
Huh.
People coming from the West Indies because there were lots of sugar coming into the dock,
you see. And that contributes to the wonderful cultural mix that you have and the early music and
all of
that fun.
Yes, what a great combination.
You know, one thing I love about Britain is the industrial cities that now are coming into their own. And if I think about it, Belfast, Glasgow, Bristol, Liverpool. What do you see they have in common?
Well, all the heavy industries have gone, haven't they now?
Yeah.
So these cities have had to reinvent themselves.
Yeah.
I mean, Liverpool was bombed to the ground during World War II, you see.
Right.
So had to rebuild, lost a lot of the trade, a lot of the industry, but it's reinvented itself. It really has. It's such a city for culture and food and sport. Only London has more museums.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
And Liverpool, it's sort of this melting pot, as you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a straight connection to Dublin and Ireland, and it's mm-hmm. close to Wales.
Mm-hmm.
And now with the train system, you're not more than 2 hours from London.
Sure.
So it's a lot of people underestimate how easily you can get around England. And if you're in London, and if you have a couple of extra days, even if you have one extra day, you could actually go to Liverpool and get a lot done.
Oh, absolutely. I pop up on the train for a weekend or even for the day, as you say.
Very nice.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Liverpool has a rich industrial heritage or a rich economy. You mm-hmm. look at the buildings and you say, oh, there must have been money here a while ago. Part of that must have been because of the slave trade.
Unfortunately, yes.
We have an email, actually, which mm-hmm. is really interesting, from Sid in Atlanta. And Sid writes, the Slavery Museum, housed along with the history of the Titanic and Liverpool's maritime history, was the most straightforward, compelling presentation of slavery's horrors and the economic underpinnings that I could ever hope to experience. After viewing this museum, I felt that until then I had had a stereotypical view of Liverpool as merely the home of the Beatles, when the city has so much more riches in culture, architecture, and maritime history.
I'm so glad he brought that up.
Yeah.
Do you know the first slave ship came from Liverpool, 1699. Isn't that amazing?
1699. And then we have this triangular trade
Absolutely.
System. Jeannie, could you please explain to us this triangular trade system of slavery? Because a lot of Americans don't realize that Britain was part of the equation.
Oh, sure. To our shame.
Yeah.
The ships would set off mainly from Liverpool, but sometimes Bristol, carrying British goods to go to Africa to exchange for captured peoples, take them across to the West Indies sugar plantations or to the southern states of America, get American goods and bring them back.
Wow.
You see? So that's the triangle.
So most of the shipping was actually done by English companies?
Oh, yes. I mean, by the 18th century was huge for slaving.
So, and there's a museum now in Liverpool.
Oh,
that,
and it's brilliant.
By all accounts,
it's absolutely right. It's a must.
So when you go to Liverpool now, we've got some very important sights to see.
Mm.
Of course, we want to see the new Slavery Museum. And you said it has more galleries and so on than London. What would a couple of galleries or museums to
see?
Oh,
it's got lovely art galleries.
Yeah.
The Walker Art Gallery, that's gorgeous.
Yeah.
The Museum of Liverpool, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
The Maritime Museum. Liverpool, which is
Liverpool
fabulous.
Tate, yeah.
Yes,
and
fabulous
the Maritime
modern
Museum.
Art.
So much. So you got history, you got art, you got an honest look at slavery. And, of course, we got the Beatles. Jeannie Carmichael's our guide to the birthplace of the Beatles and a whole lot more in Liverpool, England, right now on Travel with Rick Steves. Jeannie's a certified Blue Badge guide who offers themed tours of London with special interests in Tudor history, theater and art, fine food, and jewels. We have contact information for Jeannie in this week's show notes at ricksteves.com/radio. Jeannie, if you're a Beatle fan, Liverpool is like going to Mecca.
Oh, yes.
How would you advise somebody who's a Beatle fan to enjoy that?
Well, you can take special tours.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a bus which goes from the docks, the Albert Docks, the Magical Mystery Tour.
Right.
2 hour tour, and it takes you around all the Beatles sites. And you can go into John Lennon's old home, Paul McCartney's old home. It does tickle me because they would sit in the restroom because the acoustics were good in there.
Oh, yeah.
You can just imagine them perched on the loo.
You can learn all these fun little intimate details. Perched on the loo because the acoustics were good.
Yeah.
I never heard of that.
And Paul's father didn't like Americanisms. So when they did, she loves you, yeah, 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 he said, no, you must say she loves you, yes, yes, yes.
I'm glad Paul didn't listen too much to that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, the Beatles, of course, they say they grew up in Liverpool, but they became adults in Hamburg.
Yes.
I was in Hamburg recently, and it's got its Beatle lore there, of course. The Beatle Museum in Hamburg has recently closed because it's kind of, there's less interest there in the Beatles. But I get the sense in Liverpool, it's still a strong part of the draw, the touristic draw.
Oh, very much so. And the Beatles Story Museum is excellent.
Yeah.
Really good.
There's several museums that I can never remember the names of them, but they're generally good. And one of them is so fun. It was by the Beatles roadie or some guy. And
oh, yes.
And,
yeah, that's by the Cavern Club. Yes.
Yeah, right by on Matthew Street, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And he was collecting artifacts and beautiful things as if he knew that the Beatles would be really, really famous and he could start a museum, 20 years later or something. And it's an amazing museum.
Oh, yes, because It's so touching to think of those young men going to the port.
Yeah.
Because, of course, the ship's coming from America with all of this new amazing music.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what influenced the Beatles.
Oh, man. You get down to the harbor front and you've got this wonderful bronze statues of the Fab Four.
Mm-hmm.
And then right next to that is it the Music Museum, the British Music Experience?
Yes, because, I mean, it's not just the Beatles, of course.
Right.
Jerry and the Pacemakers,
so
Barry Cross the Mersey and all of that. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. All the way back to 1945,
oh,
I believe.
Oh, fabulous. Yeah, and Lonnie Donegan.
Oh, you got
great
it.
Stuff.
You know him,
yeah. Uh-huh.
So the British Music Experience, you've got the Cavern Quarter where the Beatles first played, mm-hmm. and Matthew Street, I think, is
the street
with that. And you've got the bus tour. And mm-hmm. usually the bus tours are run by these old-timers that have a first-hand memory of the Beatlemania.
Oh, absolutely. And they're very funny. That's the good thing.
Jeannie, it's so fun to be able to talk to you because you know so much about Liverpool. And we hear associated with Liverpool, Merseyside, about the River Mersey. It's a really important part of the city, isn't it?
Oh, it's the heart. It's
so
the point.
Tell us about the importance of the River Mersey and Merseyside, what we might do on Merseyside.
Oh, you can take harbour cruises.
Yeah.
You can take the ferry across the Mersey, across to the Wirral Peninsula.
What was the song?
Ferry across the Mersey.
So you had to say that.
I had to.
You know, anybody would hum that tune, I would imagine.
Oh, everybody knows it.
You've got to do that.
But also just down the river in the Wirral, there is an amazing development that people don't know so much about. It's called Port Sunlight.
Okay, so what is this again?
Lord Lever was a soap magnate. He made Sunlight soap.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you remember that. It was big green blocks of soap that your mum used to do the laundry with.
Okay.
And he was a multimillionaire.
Yeah.
So he built a little, well, almost like a small town for his workers on the banks of the Mersey called Port Sunlight after the soap.
And what is Port Sunlight?
And it is exquisite buildings. I mean, it was for 1,500 workers. There are 9,000 listed buildings. It's mock Tudor.
Mock Tudor.
And there's a fabulous,
so just,
fabulous art gallery because
wow.
he amassed this wonderful art collection. So you can, you know, have a day trip
going
to that.
Is this like a big amusement zone where you pay to get in? Or
No. You can just go and wander around. You pay to get the boat right there.
So it's a company town?
Yeah.
I had never heard of that.
Yeah.
And it's Port Sunlight.
Port Sunlight after the soap.
So that would be a beautiful dimension of your Liverpool visit.
There's such a lot to do. You need to go for a week.
I think if somebody goes to Liverpool, they should not make it a day trip, but they should spend the night.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah,
yes.
Because it's got a city that's got a charm day and night, and it's got a full day of sightseeing for sure.
Oh, my Lord.
Jeannie, if I was with you in Liverpool and we were going to do one hands-on activity just to gain an appreciation of the Scouse, the Liverpool people, what would be a fun thing we might do together?
I think we should go to a pub.
Okay.
I think we should go to one of the pubs that the Beatles used to go to, like the Philharmonic or the Grapes, have a pint and chat. That's the thing in Liverpool is the talk.
The talk.
Yeah. The crack,
the
as crack, they would say.
The good crack. All right. We'll go to the Philharmonic.
Yeah.
I'll see you in Liverpool at the Philharmonic.
Let's do it.
Thank you, Jeannie Carmichael, and best wishes in your tour guiding.
Thank you.
A smaller town away from the usual tourist zones can make you feel like a temporary local as you immerse yourself in the everyday culture of a European country. In just a bit, Cassandra Overby shares her strategies for picking an ideal home base. But first, classics historian Mary Beard helps us find evidence of how the Roman Empire ruled over much of Europe. It's Travel with Rick Steves. As a tour guide, I like to simplify the story of the Roman Empire like this. The Roman Empire lasted 1,000 years, from 500 BC to 500 AD. It grew for 500 years, peaked for 200 years, and fell for 300 years. Of course, that's a bit more complicated than that, but that's a good start. In our sightseeing, as we struggle to appreciate the sophistication and the grandeur of the Roman Empire, we have to remember 2,000 years ago that the word Rome no longer meant just the city. It meant what Romans considered the entire civilized world, an empire stretching from Portugal to the Middle East, and where the Mediterranean was called Mare Nostrum, our sea. Europe, at least from England and Germany to Sicily and Turkey, was littered with impressive monuments to Roman greatness. And joining us now to explore Rome beyond Rome is the British scholar and author Mary Beard. Mary is a professor of classics at Cambridge University, and she's my vote for England's most respected classicist today. Mary, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me, Rick.
You must have giggled when I gave my 25-word swing through Roman history.
Oh, I'm going to use it. I'm going to steal that.
I find it really helps. You'll hold up your arms like how big your salmon was, and then you go, it grows, it peaks, and it falls. And then you can build on that. But I do like that idea that Rome meant more than the city. But back then, 2,000 years ago, it really was the definition of what they thought was civilized, right? Wasn't it? If you spoke Greek or Latin, you were civilized and everybody else was just almost one step above animals?
And that's putting a bit strong, I think. And of course, what we don't have is we don't have much of the view of the people they conquered. And I'm afraid some of the poor old Brits, for example, or the Germans or the Spanish, they might have thought that the Romans were the barbarians.
So I'm a victim of Roman propaganda. 2,000 years later, I'm still victimized by it.
I'm afraid. I mean, we all are, you know.
That's so interesting because I'm wondering, is it good or bad from, let's say, a, quote, barbarian person in Britannia that was taken over by the Roman Empire? Was it actually stability and effective governance and here comes running water with aqueducts and roads where you can get from one place to the other without spending a lifetime? Was it good to be conquered by the Roman Empire in the terms of 2,000 years ago?
Depends who you were, I think. If you think about Britain, and Britain is the kind of least important province in the whole of the Roman Empire, it's a total backwater. Some of the old tribal leaders in Britain did very nicely out of the Romans. And I'm sure they thought that going in with Rome, you know, was good. And they probably did think that a bit of running water was quite nice. I think an awful lot of people in the country didn't even notice the Romans. They were paying taxes to a new guy, but they'd paid taxes before. And nobody much bothered them. You know, a lot of other people, I suspect, thought that they were living under a military dictatorship, and in some ways they were. So I think people related to the Roman Empire differently, wherever they were.
Mary, we've got a few minutes where I would like to just review some sites in Europe that illustrate how Rome spread and the humanity of it all. And I'll just talk about a couple. There's a thing called the Trophy of the Alps, and it's near Monaco and Nice, up in the mountains. Yeah. It's this amazing monument from 7 BC that celebrates Augustus conquering and quelling 45 barbarian tribes in the Alps. And each tribe's name is carved in the stone.
Yeah.
When you look at that, have you seen that?
Yeah, I've been a long time ago, but yes.
Yeah, what's the propaganda value of that? It's not a fortification. It was just something bragging on a bluff.
No, it is power at its most boastful. And I think what Rome is very adept at doing is stamping its own mark on the landscape. It's saying, Rome is here. Rome has conquered. And you get these big monuments like that Trapium.
Yeah.
But it goes down to things as simple, I think, as Roman roads. I mean, we think of Roman roads as things which are very useful because it gets the Roman army from A to B. And up to a point, that's true. But it's also saying, look at what I can do. Look at me. I am making my mark by laying this unnecessarily kind of well-made road right across your land. Or you'd say the same, I think, about Hadrian's Wall and the north of England. And people have often wondered about what this great wall going across the British Isles was. And, you know, it's not stupid to think it's a kind of marker of where the Roman Empire ends.
Uh-huh.
And it's partly to keep the Scottish out. I mean, actually, it's not a very good defensive wall. And I think any self-respecting Scot would have got over it pretty quickly. What I think when I see Hadrian's Wall is not so much that it's got that kind of practical purpose, though in part it might have. It's also saying, look at what I can do. I can build a wall right across Britain.
This is Travel with Rick Steves, and we're exploring what remains of the far reaches of the ancient Roman Empire now with Mary Beard. She's been teaching and writing about ancient Rome for over 30 years as a professor of classics at Cambridge University. She's the author of about 20 books, including her most recent title, Emperor of Rome. You can find a link to Mary's work in this week's show notes at ricksteves.com/radio. Mary, when you think about that monument I mentioned down by the Riviera, quelling those barbarian tribes, you could have the best road in the world, but if the barbarian tribes are making it dangerous to drive on it, it's not a very good road.
Yeah, there is a degree of pacification. I mean, we talk about the Pax Romana, the Roman peace, and that sounds kind of quite nice, really, the Pax Romana. I mean, I think it sounds a bit less nice and a bit more correct if you say, look, Pax is the result of violence.
Well, the Pax Romana, I go back to that same Trophy of the Alps, the centerpiece is a Roman soldier with his jackboot on the neck of a barbarian who's humbled at his feet.
Exactly.
So there you go. There's peace.
Roman peace is won by violence. And in some ways, one of the best examples of that is that very famous statue of the Emperor Marcus Aurelius that stood in the center of Rome and put by Michelangelo on the Capitoline Piazza. And Marcus Aurelius looks terribly calm. He's on a bronze horse. He's looking frightfully philosophical. And you know, it looks almost as if he's controlling his horse just by the sense of his own powerful calm. What's really interesting is the horse's front hoof is raised. And people very rarely say, so what was under that front hoof? Well, almost certainly a dying barbarian originally, which hasn't survived. So even those kind of now icons of Roman calm and authority, I think originally there was someone getting squashed by that horse.
You know, I think that would be an interesting essay with what's at the foot of the conqueror's horse.
Yeah,
because exactly. You can see it in the tapestry for the Battle of Hastings. You can see it where Christians are cutting off the heads of Muslims at St. James, the Moor Slayer.
Yeah.
And I didn't know you could see it under the hoof of Emperor. Who was the emperor on this?
Marcus Aurelius.
Marcus Aurelius.
You know, the famous Stoic, best-selling emperor even now with his Meditations.
So our challenge in our travels is to kind of humanize our sightseeing. And I always come back to needy people marveling at great technology. I mean, we all see the Pont du Gard in southern France, and we marvel at the biggest Roman arch, I think, in existence, going over the river, not realizing it's a 30-mile-long structure designed to bring water into the Roman city of Nîmes.
Yeah.
And then a few miles away from Nîmes, there's this series of water mills, stair-stepping down a hill run by an aqueduct, and it powers 16 water mills. This is 1,800 years ago, grinding grain to feed the masses. When you are inspiring people to appreciate Rome, how do you illustrate how amazing Rome was?
Well, I think aqueducts are quite a good way of doing that, actually, because when I first started out doing television, they always wanted to take me to aqueducts. And I used to say, oh, aqueducts are very boring. You know, they're really boring. All they do is bring water in. Oh, come on, you can do better than that. And of course, I went around some of those aqueducts in southern Europe, both in France and Spain, and suddenly I saw, again, this is the power of the conqueror, but it's also the power of technology. You know, you look at these aqueducts and they are enormously both wasteful and efficient ways of bringing water into Roman towns. And I've kind of had a bit of a thought change about aqueducts. But when I find myself getting to admire them too much, what I tend to do is to try to remember how aqueducts appear in Roman legal cases. Some of it is things that we'd be very familiar with. You know, people are worried about the aqueducts leaking and people siphoning off the water from the aqueduct to use it themselves. What I like to remind people of is that there are an awful lot of legal cases which concern the homeless who are actually living under the arches of the aqueducts. So you've got fantastic technology, really extraordinary. It's gobsmacking.
Yeah.
But underneath, you've got the homeless trying to get a bit of shelter under the stonework.
Was that in classical times or during the early Middle Ages?
In classical times.
During the Roman Empire, you have desperation where people just look at an aqueduct and find it a source of shelter.
Yes, that's right. They do the same with big tombs as well. You know, we never see the homeless in ancient Rome because they sort of don't leave a trace. and they rarely come into the great literature. And you think, right, okay, I've got to put the poor back in this landscape. And they're living here too, actually.
You know, I've always thought of the poor being in the terms of the early Middle Ages, what was used to be called the Dark Ages, where people who were desperate would literally move into Roman ruins. The old, you know, yeah. Diocletian's palace in Split was just inhabited by a bunch of homeless people.
Yes.
And it became the modern city of Split. But it's interesting that you bring it back to the more harsh reality yeah. that this desperation was right there in juxtaposition with all of the wealth and the power.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a wonderful little wall painting in Pompeii, which pretty rarely shows the daily life in the Roman Forum. And in one of the scenes, there's a beggar. There's a guy with his dog holding out his hat for money. And we don't usually see the poor and the beggars.
Mary Beard's our guest on Travel with Rick Steves, helping us find and understand the signs that remain of the ancient Roman Empire in Europe and England. Mary is the classics editor of the Times Literary Supplement and muses on things ancient and modern in her column called A Don's Life. Mary has a long list of awards and honors, including being named a Dame Commander of the Order of the British Empire. She's a well-known presenter and guest on British television and radio, a trustee of the British Museum, and the author of some 20 books, including SPQR, A History of Ancient Rome. Her latest title is Emperor of Rome, Ruling the Ancient Roman World. Mary, we are just about out of time, but you're from Britain. I love this phrase that I keep finding when I'm traveling through the west part of England. They say, if you scratch Gloucestershire, you can find ancient Rome. Have you heard that?
No, but you scratch almost anywhere in Britain and you can find ancient Rome.
Tell us about evidence of the impact of Rome on your homeland 2,000 years ago.
Well, I think, you know, I actually go back to my own childhood. I came not from Gloucestershire, but I came from Shropshire, which is on the border between Wales and England. And one of the ways I first got into Roman history was digging up the Roman town, which was 4 miles from the place I live, a place called Wroxeter. And I spent my summers getting my hands dirty in the real remains of ancient Rome.
You found bits of ancient Rome just by digging when you were a child?
Yeah, yes.
You know, because I have a friend who was in northern England, and he said in Roman times, people would often bury their coins outside of the town before they went in. And if they never came out, they never got their coins again. And there's a lot of Roman coins in the dirt outside yep. of ancient towns.
Yeah, I mean, there are. They also tended to bury their coins when it looked as if there was kind of trouble ahead. And they thought, I've got to bury these.
Yeah, and then the trouble was their last chapter.
The trouble was their last chapter.
And then 2,000 years later, Mary yeah, Beard comes by
them,
with her
yeah.
girlfriend from school, and they find these coins.
I tend to think that sometimes they forgot where they buried them. That would have been my problem.
Maybe that was it. But, you know, Roman coins, I'm a coin collector, and they are remarkably inexpensive in
yes.
the antique shops of England.
Because there are thousands of them. And I tell you, and they get all over the world, not just in Europe. There are thousands of Roman coins found in India because, you know, the Romans were trading with India for spices and silks, etc. India is one of the best places to find a Roman coin.
Okay, here's a little game because we're just going to wrap it up and you're from England and I love the traces of Rome in England. I'm going to just give two things that inspire me in England about ancient Rome. When I'm in the Cotswold areas, a road is perfectly straight. And somebody tells me, well, that's the way the Roman engineers built it 2,000 years ago. Of course, it's modern paved today. But underneath that is literally the cobbles of that Roman road. And that road might have been leading to a town called Aquasulis, which was the first name of the mineral spa town of Bath. And people from ancient Rome would go from Londinium out to Aquasulis to take the waters. And in that Roman bath, we can see the Roman bath to this day, there's a statue of Minerva, the goddess of that mineral bath, which is so exquisite, you'd expect to find it in the emperor's palace way away in the city of Rome, but it's right there in rural England. Two little indications of, whoa, things were going on in Britannia. How about you? What is something that you find remarkable that way?
Well, in some ways, I kind of share your sights. I mean, I think that, you know, it took me a long time to realize that the transport system of Britain and its road network was still essentially the Roman road network. You know, why is the capital city of London in such a stupid place right on the edge? It's because the Romans put it there. And, you know, places like Bath, I think, are just amazing because, again, you see two sides of Roman Britain there. You see the very grand, very impressive side. But recently, a whole load of lead tablets have been excavated in Bath, which are thrown into the sacred spring of Aquasulis. And if you decipher what's written on these lead tablets, again, you get to the ordinary people of Roman Britain, because they're things like saying, "O Minerva, I want to curse that awful man who stole my cloak, and I hope he rots in hell." Right? So you have this kind of wonderful combination of human personal problems about lost property written on these tablets, which are dedicated to the goddess. And then you've got this very posh shrine, which could almost have come from, you know, Italy itself.
I wish everybody could be looking at you as I am on this connection right now and see the joy in your face when you talk about bringing Rome to life. And that comes through in your book, Emperor of Rome. Mary Beard, thank you so much for joining us, and best wishes with your teaching and inspiring people to appreciate history and what we can learn from it.
Thank you.
Mary Beard tells us about a tribal queen of the ancient Brits who led a failed uprising against the conquering Romans, and why she's honored as a national heroine with a statue right outside Parliament in London. It's in a short extra to today's interview. You can hear it at ricksteves.com/radio. There's more than one way to conquer the hiking trails of Europe. Up next, Cassandra Overby explains how finding the right kind of home base can be an ideal way to design a long-distance hiking itinerary without having to carry all your stuff with you every day, and it helps you to fit in for a while into some delightful small towns and villages. You're listening to Travel with Rick Steves. It was right here in our radio studio where I first met our next guest a few years ago. Cassandra Overby dropped in to share with us her love of hiking in Europe. In all my years of travel, this was a dimension of Europe that I'd never really gotten to appreciate. I was so taken by her passion for hiking as an ideal way to explore and enjoy Europe's great outdoors that I flew her to France. Cassandra was my on-camera sidekick as my TV crew filmed along the Tour de Mont Blanc Trail, the one that circles around the great mountain that borders France, Italy, and Switzerland. We had so much fun faking for the camera that we were actually hiking the full 100-mile trail that I made a plan to return and actually complete it in full with my girlfriend the following year. It turned out to be my first real vacation in a long time, and with Cass's savvy advice, Shelley and I caught the hiking bug in a big way, where you can immerse yourself in European nature and culture at a walking pace that really lets you savor it all. Cassandra Overby is with us again on Travel with Rick Steves to tell us what she's discovered for her latest book. It's called Home Base Hiking Europe. Cass, welcome back.
Thank you so much. I always love our chats. Look forward to them.
Yeah, well, I've got a hiking vacation coming up, so I'm going to learn a little bit right now, just like all of our listeners who may not know it, but they could have some great hiking in their future travels. So I know your first book well, Explore Europe on Foot, and now you followed it with Home Base Hiking Europe. Why home base hiking? Tell us about home base.
So in the past, I had done a lot of village to village and hut to hut hiking. And there came a point in my life when I had kids and it became very difficult for me to do such a logistically difficult trip. Mm-hmm. As far as changing accommodations every night and worrying about how much stuff I had on my back and what I needed to bring for the family. And so I tried out staying in a village for, 7 to 10 days and doing day hikes from there. And I really didn't think it was going to be as amazing as what I had done before with the longer trips and the long trails, but I was shocked. So I really felt like with home base hiking, I got to explore the villages and get to know them on a way deeper level. I gained a greater cultural appreciation for the places that I were. And there was so much variety for day hikes that I didn't feel like I was sacrificing anything with regard to great hiking. And I thought, you know, there are a lot of other people who don't want to do a 15-day trail or a 7-day trail, stay in huts along the way. There are a lot of other people who want a few more creature comforts and want to get to know local people and have more choice in what they hike every day and more flexibility.
Yes. So the conventional thing where you're hiking day after day, going in a direction, not coming back to your home base, you either carry all your gear with you or you take a tour that provides some kind of a Sherpa service where they line up the hotels and they take your bag ahead and you just go with your day bag. But either way, you're changing locations every night and there's pros and cons, but it is pretty cool to find a home base that really merits coming home to. And then, as you said, after 3 or 4 days, you feel like this is your home, you're a regular, you know the ropes.
Right. And it's nice because when you're picking up your hiking snacks, you know, you're going to the shop that has the meat and cheeses, you're going to get your fresh baguette every morning to take out with you on your day hike, you go to the wine shop. And because you're visiting those places on a daily basis, you get to talk to those people and, you know, you get to form real relationships. And one of my favorite things is that you get to find your restaurant, like the place where you love the food, the love, the ambiance, the place you want to go back to for every meal. And when you home base hike, you actually can go back for dinner every night. And I've done that and I love it.
And you can amp up the appreciation. So when you think about this sort of, it's a module. You can go, you can have a 12-day vacation and you could have 3 different home bases, couldn't you?
Right. And that's actually what I love to do. Mm-hmm. So I like to pair very different home bases. So a lot of times I'll pair something really mountainous, like in the Alps and the Dolomites, along with something that's a coastal hike or maybe a vineyard hike. Mm-hmm. And it provides a lot of dimension because especially if you're staying in the same country, you get to know very different aspects of the culture and the landscape.
Okay. So this book, Home Base Hiking in Europe, what you've done is you've chosen a dozen or so chapters. You've got the Dolomites in Italy, the Somme in France, Costa Brava, Spain, Provence, France, Lake Bohin in Slovenia, that's the Julian Alps, the Jungfrau in Switzerland, Piedmont in Italy, Dalmatian Coast in Croatia, Berchtesgaden National Park in Bavaria, and the Wachau Valley in Austria, just on the Danube above Vienna. Those are all, just reading those, I kind of got excited. I don't know what it is, but excuse me just a moment. That was really fun. But each one's different, isn't it? Tell me about choosing a base. Oh, we don't have time to talk about all of them, but grab one of these spots and tell me about the home base and the hikes you would enjoy from there.
Right. So I really like hiking along the Danube, and you can do that when you stay in Dürnstein. And as you mentioned, that is close to Vienna. So it's a really nice way to pair big city Europe with very small town vineyard Europe. And you have this beautiful river that a lot of people think about in terms of river boating. Mm-hmm. So they will go river boating down the Danube and visit little villages along the way. And so some of those villages along the way really fill up during the day. But if you actually do home base hiking and you home base in one of those spots, like I recommend in my book, then while everybody from the cruises is in the town during the day, you are actually hiking the vineyards and the hills around, and you're hiking alongside the river, and you're missing all of the crowds taking in that landscape. And then when you go back to your accommodations that night, all of the cruise ship passengers have gotten back on their cruises, and you have the town to yourself. And so I love hiking in that area because there's so much history and also really amazing food. And when you hike through the vineyards, you know, you can see some of the things that make that wine so special and the ancient walls that's really a lost art. Nobody these days really knows how to repair a lot of the walls that are in the vineyards. And you get to taste a lot of the elements of the local landscape in the wine. So you can stop at little tiny huergas along the way.
I love that you've been walking over the fences and through the vineyards. And then in the evening, you can actually taste the fruit of the vine.
Right. And even along the way. So several of my hikes stop at these huergas along the way. So you can stop and take, you know, a pause for 45 minutes.
And have get a couple of glasses
and a glass of wine.
Well, that's good. Let's take a taxi home. No, you can carry on. That's, you know, what I like about your approach is, of course, we love the hiking, but you've got the history and the culture and the cuisine and you can mix it all together. And that's just hiking in Europe is, you're missing half the joy. It's connecting in high altitudes often cases, but with traditional cultures.
Right. And that's the thing. I don't say go hiking in Europe because it's this amazing outdoor experience or it's exercise. I say hike in Europe because it gets you into the best small towns. It gets you to the real local culture, and you get amazing landscape and amazing exercise.
Oh, man, I'm just thinking of some hikes I've had, and you're so right. We're getting you ready to hike the historic trails of Europe with the advice of Cassandra Overby right now on Travel with Rick Steves. She outlines the details for planning multi-day hikes or day trip excursions in her books, Explore Europe on Foot, and her latest title, Home Base Hiking Europe. Cassandra's also written detailed guides to long-distance hiking trails in the Alsace wine region of France, along Germany's King Ludwig Way in Bavaria, and for the coastal trail between St. Malo and Mont-Saint-Michel in Brittany. You'll find links to her work in the notes for today's show at ricksteves.com/radio. So, Cassandra, if you're choosing a base, would you say it kind of comes down to high alpine thrills, seaside, or villages? Or what three categories would you say a home base would you think of in terms of cobbling this together?
Right. So I do a lot of coastal trails and a lot of coastal towns because you have some amazing coastline. And one of the benefits of that is actually that you can go to those regions in the south of Europe in the shoulder seasons and beat the crowd. So coastline is one of my favorite types of hiking in Europe. Then you do have the high alpine stuff and the foothills of the Alps if you don't want to have to stay in mountain huts or high alpine
spots. And you've got pastoral. I would think Piedmont is kind of pastoral. Of course, the Cotswold villages would be pastoral.
Right.
Tell me about a pastoral hiking, because I've dabbled with hiking in the Cotswolds in England and West England, and it is just so charming.
So one of my favorite spots, and a spot that's in this book, is La Mora in Italy. And, you know, everybody wants to go and they want to visit vineyards in Italy. They go to Tuscany, and there are so many people in Tuscany. But if you go to a spot like La Mora, you're going to have really amazing wine like Barolo, Barbaresco. And when you hike there, it's not really a tourist destination. Right. I mean, you have some Italians there. But, you know, when you walk through the village, you'll have a line of cars because there are tractors going through the town.
That's good. I like that.
Right. Yeah. And when you go out through the vineyards, you have, you know, a lot of farm workers that you see. And so it's a lot of very rolling hills. It's not steep, but it's also has some amazing views of the mountains in the distance, can make some really nice sunset hikes. And I love those rolling hills because, you know, you do get good exercise, but they provide just kind of changing views all the time.
So now let's think, you've got a good home base, and you can have a home base up in the Alps, on the coast, on the riverbank, in the vineyards, but you got a home base that you like. Now, when you think about it, I don't like to hike out and back on the same trail. So you got options. You can do a loop hike, or I suppose you could catch public transportation or a taxi 10 miles away and hike home.
Right. So I cover a lot of those kinds of hikes because I'm like you. I don't like to see the same scenery twice.
Right.
So a lot of my hikes are either loops or they're doable with public transportation.
So you go one way on foot and the other way, retrace your steps or whatever.
Yes.
On public transportation.
And even better, a lot of times you take public transportation up to the high altitude. Then you hike at the high altitude. You get the good views and you walk down.
I love it. Or you can take a lift up and hike down.
Yeah.
Okay, back to your home base. You got a loop trail. You got the boring go out and go back on the same trail. You've got the option to take a taxi or a public bus out or up and come back down or vice versa.
Right.
And you've got the opportunity to take a lift. You've also got the opportunity to take a lift up, traverse, and take a lift back down.
Right.
Now, do you factor some of those options into your day hiking plans from home bases?
I do, yeah. So I try to look at places that give options. So especially when I'm doing higher altitude hikes, I try to provide options for people who want a really strenuous hike, then the people who want a medium hike, and the people who want an easier hike. And I try to provide them tips for the hikes that I offer and then how to tweak them to be at each level.
Nice. You know, I'm taking a hike for a week, in the Dolomites later this year. And it's kind of a mix of what you're talking about, because it's this company's putting on, and it's called the Comfort Dolomites.
Mm.
And what it is two nights at every stop. So you hike from point to point, and then you have a day to hike out and back, and then you hike to another point, and then you have a day from there. So it's little mini home bases.
Yeah, that's great.
And I like that because you've got your sense of going someplace, but you've also always got your sense of two nights in a row instead of a series of one-night stops.
Yeah.
When you are out and about day hiking, you're not going to have a fancy backpack as if you're hiking multi-days with all your gear. But
no.
You do have to have a good day bag. And I've learned that a silly little day bag is a very penny-wise and pound-foolish mistake.
Right.
You need to spend some money to get a good scientifically designed day bag, I think.
Yeah. What I recommend to people is that they go to their favorite outdoor store. And a lot of those stores will have bags of weights that you can put in the bags that you want to try out. And then, you know, they will adjust the bag for you. Mm-hmm. And you should find a really good fit. And some things to look for in a bag are water bottle holsters, for sure.
Uh-huh.
It's difficult to have a water bladder oftentimes when you're in Europe because you can't clean it properly like you would at home. And then also, you want to make sure that you have a waist belt because there are a lot of packs out there that look good and sound good. But if they don't have a waist belt, all that weight is going to be on your shoulders and it's going to be really uncomfortable.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Cassandra Overby. She's the writer and a travel enthusiast who wants to revolutionize travel one hike at a time. Her newest book is Home Base Hiking Europe. And it gives travelers an alternative way to experience Europe from a home base with 10 great, selected by Cassandra, hiking hubs. You can also hear our past radio interviews with Cassandra and watch her Monday night travel presentation about hiking the Camino de Santiago on her website. And that's exploreonfoot.com. Cassandra, I did a kind of a home base thing in Lauterbrunnen Valley a couple years ago. And one day we spent renting a mountain bike. And I would imagine from almost any home base, you've got bike rental places.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's a fun thing to do to mix it in with your hiking.
Right. So something that's really cool about a lot of these mountain villages that are good for hiking is that they're also really great for biking. And a lot of them have ski lifts and have gondolas where you can take the mountain bikes up and then bike down.
That's great fun.
Yeah.
That's great fun. So talk to your, I suppose a guidebook would explain that, like home base hiking in Europe, or you can talk to the people you're staying with or the tourist information office in that town. What about seasonal concerns? I would imagine you have to factor that in on when you schedule to do these hikes.
Yeah, so when you go to Europe to hike really depends on what you want to see the most. If you want to see high mountain views, then you really need to go in July or August when the mountains are guaranteed to be snow-free. Because you can still get some late snow in June. You can get some early snow even in the first, you know, couple weeks of September. So July and August are your days. But if you want to travel outside of that, all you need to do is go south a little bit or go to a flatter spot, a more pastoral spot.
Uh-huh.
So you can hike in Portugal, in Spain, Croatia, different places like that really well in February, March, April.
I can imagine hiking anywhere in the Mediterranean in the winter.
Right.
And just as long as you have decent clothing, it can be great.
Yes,
in
because
fact,
it's usually very mild.
There's something mystical about the weather that you can enjoy, and it gives you a whole extra dimension. Hey, I know that your kids now are, what, 7 and 4 years old?
Mm-hmm.
Now, you've been taking them with you, and I've noticed it shows up in your books.
Yeah.
Is home base hiking Europe to a certain degree just because, hey, it's easier with kids?
Well, I mean, part of it is I needed to switch how I traveled because I love to travel. I'm going to be out there, and my family has to come with me if I'm going to continue to do that. So it is a very family-friendly way to travel. But now, I mean, it's something that really identifies our family. And my kids love talking about going to Europe. They like talking about how they're hikers. You know, I think it's the best way to show them the real Europe and to have them meet local kids and see what huts are like in playgrounds in other countries.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been talking with Cassandra Overby. Her book is Home Base Hiking in Europe. Cassandra, you radiate with enthusiasm. I wish everybody could sit across the table from you and talk to you about hiking in Europe. What is it about hiking? We're out of time now, but just share one magic moment where you just kind of go, I don't know why everybody doesn't do this all the time. This is just the greatest experience.
So I was in the Dolomites, and I signed myself up for a sunrise Via Ferrata. And a Via Ferrata involves clipping into some cables and going up metal ladders. And the little transport shuttle picked me up at, I think, 4 a.m. And it was dark. I was tired. It was cold out. But, you know, I thought, this is an adventure, and it's going to be amazing. And so, you know, in the dark, we made our way up the mountain and we were at the top of this peak, Grand Chir, and the sun came up and I could see all of the peaks around me. And there were people making tea on their little backpacking stoves up there. And there was a whole sense of camaraderie among the handful of people who had braved the trail that morning. And it was such a magical moment, like a moment that you look around and you think, there are so few of these moments that you'll actually remember at the end of your life. And you can take a picture in your mind and you can get those experiences when you're hiking.
Wow. Harnessed up with your carabiners?
Yes.
Clipped to an iron cable?
Right.
As the sun's rising over all those beautiful Dolomite peaks?
It was amazing.
Life is good.
Life was good until the storm moved in. And then it was even more memorable.
All right. Cassandra Overby, thanks for joining us and happy hiking.
Thanks so much for having me.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington by Tim Tatton, Kasmura Hall, and Donna Bardsley. You can find links to our guests, listen to a podcast version of the show, and search the archives at ricksteves.com/radio. We'll look for you again next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
Monday Night Travel. It's a weekly travel party and you're invited. Zoom in and have some fun learning about Europe's art, history, culture, and food over drinks and snacks. It's free, it's an adventure, and be careful, it can be addictive. Join me and my travel buddies over Zoom for Monday Night Travel. We're live every week, starting at 6 p.m. Pacific Time, 9 p.m. Eastern. Register at ricksteves.com and BYOB.